that most people don't understand. But look at what Byatt was saying, what we wanted. We wanted full employment. The civil rights movement...
We have 10 seconds.
We wanted full employment and things that were both were economic in nature.
And I think what's so fascinating is that when the Civil Rights Act was signed, now the emphasis on LBJ, it was about movements, yes, leading into that moment. Yes. You were a part of that movement, leading 700 people protesting in the World's Fair a few
Absolutely.
Months before. Norman and Velma Hill, I want to thank you so much for being with us to remind us of this historical moment, or teach us about a moment we didn't even know about. That does it for the broadcast. I'll be speaking at the Green Fest at 54th Street, Pier 94 in New York, Saturday at 3. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO is looking for a membership director. Duties include database management, conducting mailings, producing reports, assisting members managing pledge drives, and, of course, working closely with other staff members here at the station. The ability to work with numerous people in a fast-paced environment is essential. This is a mix of part-time and full-time work, with 40 hours per week being required leading up to, during, and following each membership drive. A full benefit package is included. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Our organization does not discriminate on the basis of age, race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, class, creed, physical or mental disability. For a more detailed job description and printable job application, go to kboo.fm, search for hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G. And to apply, please send a resume via email to hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G, at kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking to as many Oregon State judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidates for 2014 office as I can. And I've been talking to them all. Deep blue, progressive, liberal, democratic, centrist, independent, republican, conservative, libertarian, deep red. Many of these candidates get ignored by the mainstream media, but they're not ignored here. Hear these interviews on my podcast at www.kbu.fm/between us. Listen to the people who want to lead you in 2014. Oregon State judicial, legislative, and gubernatorial candidate interviews at my podcast, www.kbu.fm/between us.
The time is 5:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up right now is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Cover Oregon officials announced that they will hand the state's healthcare exchange website over to the federal government.
Standard & Poor's rates in Russia.
And an update on the Fukushima power plant.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 25th, 2014. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Liam Delta. The diplomatic war of words between the administrations of President Obama and President Vladimir Putin of Russia is heating up. Free Speech Radio News' Simon Marks filed this report.
I spoke with Rich Wood, a spokesman for the Washington Education Association. He started out by telling me how Washington State has gone to this point.
Years ago, Congress and George W. Bush passed a law called No Child Left Behind, which was an update of our national ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And that was going on almost 15 years ago. And everybody recognizes that No Child Left Behind is outdated, it's obsolete, it's unrealistic. But Congress is gridlocked. And even though Congress was supposed to update it now going on 7 years ago, it was really an example of how this is a failed law. It's a failed policy. And fortunately, in Washington State, the legislature stood up to that.
What does it mean that Washington State has lost its waiver?
What it means is that the school districts in our state will lose some flexibility around spending some federal money, but that money is still going to come to Washington State. It's still going to be dedicated to helping low-income students. That money is not going away. It's still coming here, and school districts will have to notify parents that schools aren't living up to the unrealistic standards that everybody agrees are flawed and ridiculous, frankly, contained in No Child Left Behind.
And this really goes back to Washington State lawmakers deciding not to use student scores as a component of teacher evaluation. Is that right?
That's right. They decided not to mandate the use of state test scores and teacher evaluations. Any school district in our state could use those state test scores and teacher evaluations right now if they wanted to. But as far as I know, there's only one that does, and in a very limited way, and not at all in the way that that the federal government was trying to force us to do. So yes, school districts can use those state test scores right now, but frankly, there's no evidence or research to suggest that that actually helps improve teaching or strengthen a teacher's ability to meet the needs of students. There's absolutely no evidence or research to suggest that that's a helpful thing. It has nothing to do with what's good for kids and or good for their teachers. And that's why I believe the legislature in Washington rejected that policy.
How can we sort of move forward? What are the steps that the Washington Educators Association is looking forward to?
We would want Secretary Duncan to remember what he said just a few months ago when he called Superintendent Dorn and congratulated him. Superintendent Dorn highlighted the fact that the Secretary of the Department of Education was congratulating our state on our student success. So I would hope that they would remember that in Washington State, we do have quality public education. Our students are doing well. Our teachers are working hard to implement that new teacher evaluation system, so we would hope that they would support that.
That was Rich Wood, a spokesman for the Washington Educators Association. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Excuse us. That was Ryan Katz speaking about rescinding the Washington State's waiver to the No Child Left Behind Act.
Today, Oregon moved to become the first state to dump its troubled online health exchange and use the federal marketplace instead. Cover Oregon's board decided to ditch its troubled online health care exchange for all but Medicaid enrollments. But to continue using the current technology for Medicaid, it will have to spend another $35 million plus $4 to $6 million to switch to the federal system for all other forms of health care insurance. Cover Oregon said the federal government would pay 90% of those costs. The failure of Cover Oregon is a saga several years and several hundred million dollars in the making, mostly under Governor Kitzhaber's watch. The governor agreed with today's decision, saying it is most reliable and the most cost-effective way to get a working insurance exchange in time for fall's enrollment period. The Obama administration is poised to take over the broken system, along with several other state-run health exchanges that, like Oregon's, are too dysfunctional to fix. So far, about 240,000 Oregonians have enrolled in coverage over Cover Oregon using a cumbersome paper-based application process that involved millions of dollars of additional cost to the state and considerable hassle to Oregonians. Cover Oregon's fate next year is doubtful because its source of funding will largely disappear with the move to federal exchange.
And now we have that story about the diplomatic war of words between President Obama and President Vladimir Putin of Russia. This is Simon Marks filing this report.
I think it's very clear that Russia, from the get-go, from intervening militarily in Crimea to what they're currently doing in eastern Ukraine, which clearly is orchestrated and clearly is carried out and funded by Moscow, is really intended to do all of those things that Secretary Kerry said. So I think it's clear that even after the Geneva Agreement that was recently reached, Russia has continued to promote pro-Russian separatists occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine. They have not called on these people to disarm or to stop their actions. And more recently, Russia has also carried out extensive military exercises across the border from Ukraine. So I think it's very clear that Russia has not sought to de-escalate. On the other hand, they have escalated the situation even further.
Right. But Barack Obama today, he during his Four Nation Asia tour, he broke from that briefly to talk to some of his European Union counterparts. And it seems sanctions are being teed up, as we learned yesterday, that seems to be the case. But will this threat actually register with Vladimir Putin? He has, whenever we've seen him on TV, on state TV in Russia, he's cut a fairly untroubled figure so far in response to whatever punitive measures have been thrown at him from the US and the EU.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that the punitive measures or the sanctions that so far have been imposed on Russia have really been very gradual. They've been fairly insignificant. Now we're the U.S. and possibly the European Union is going to attempt to impose more sanctions. But I really think that this strategy of gradually imposing them, waiting for Putin to take the next step rather than trying to shape the events by putting some pressure on him from the beginning, has been a wrong strategy. So I think looking at these latest reports of further sanctions, I think it's very important that they are more far-reaching than so far, and that they also target some people in the Russian business sector with connections to the Kremlin, mm-hmm. not just politicians. And right. I think it's that seems to be the route that Washington is willing to take. At the same time, I think there are indications that we're not looking to impose broader economic sanctions on entire economic sectors, such as the energy sector in Russia. So we're still looking at individuals in the business and in the political communities. But that's a good step, and it's also very unclear whether the European Union is willing to go as far as the U.S. seems to be willing to go at this point.
The ratings agency Standard & Poor's actually announced today, didn't they, that Russia's credit status is hovering just above junk status, and there's been an exodus in the tens of billions in the first quarter from Russia in terms of capital. So perhaps hitting Russia financially is the way forward?
Yeah, I do think we have some leverage that we should use to our advantage. And so therefore, I think imposing sanctions on the financial sector could be a very powerful tool, even in the short term. I think that could foment some domestic political pressure on Putin in Russia. And I think that's probably our best chance right now. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also very important that as we consider those kind of sanctions, that we really have the U.S. and the EU working together. Because if we're going to be successful in putting pressure on Russia, it really also takes the Europeans to go along a similar approach. And so far, the indications that I've heard from Europe is that there's still a great deal of reluctance among several EU member states to push for such far-reaching sanctions.
But the fact remains that Russia has said that they will protect their interests. We've seen this film before in Crimea.
And in Georgia in 2008, mm-hmm. I think these are some very, very worrying signals that are coming from Moscow. They're essentially threatening to intervene militarily if the Ukrainian government continues in carrying out their so-called anti-terrorist operation, which so far has not really done much to seek to disrupt the pro-Russian separatists in parts of eastern Ukraine. So I think it's a very tense situation, mm-hmm. and it could easily take a turn for the worse. And therefore, I think it's very important that we seek to preempt such a possible Russian military intervention by putting firm pressure on them right now and declaring that would be something that would be absolutely unacceptable. I think that must be the way forward at this point.
Can the Ukraine military offer any sort of resistance to a Russian invasion?
No, they couldn't, and they know that. I think it's important that we not only provide strong political support for the territorial integrity of Ukraine, provide them with economic support, but we should also consider ways of supporting them militarily through trainings, through non-lethal military assistance, through intelligence sharing and those kind of things. But ultimately, both the Russians and the Ukrainians know that if Vladimir Putin wanted to move in with a full-scale military invasion, the Ukrainians would not have much of a chance.
And finally, Eric, one other interesting aspect of John Kerry's statement yesterday was his attack on Russia's propaganda engine room. And I wanted to ask, how important to Mr. Putin's plans is the state-run media in all of this, especially in the age of social media?
I think it is very significant, and we've seen that throughout this entire crisis since it started in Crimea and even before then on the squares of the Maidan Square in Kiev, that Russian propaganda is very significant. And I think it's we haven't really figured out a way of effectively countering that. There's been some attempts by the United States government, by NATO, to put information out to the general public, sometimes using social media tools. And I think this is an effective way that we should consider doing more of to counter some of the propaganda that's coming from Russia. In many ways, this is an information warfare, an information war, and we need to be at the forefront in discrediting false information that is coming from Moscow right now.
And now it's time for news from our friends over at Native News Radio.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native Americans from across the U.S. are holding protests on the National Mall this week. Matt Laszlo reports on why a pipeline debate has brought them to D.C.
Here in Washington, the debate over the Keystone XL pipeline, which would deliver tar sand oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast, has centered on whether it will create jobs or increase global warming. But the tribes that would be impacted say the debate should be about what it would mean for their sacred lands. That's why Cyril Scott, president of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe of South Dakota, is joining dozens of other Native leaders on the mall this week.
We're trying to save our grandchildren, their grandchildren. This land is not ours. We have borrowed it from the future generations. So we need to leave it just as we found it, or as close as we could.
Tribal leaders have been educating national media about the high crime rates in Indian Country. A part of their argument against the pipeline is that bringing in hundreds of non-Native contractors to build the pipeline will lead to more sexual assaults in their communities. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Representatives of Pacific Northwest tribes met with Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell Thursday. At a conference in Washington State, Jewell discussed federal efforts to address economic and social issues and climate change. Jewell highlighted federal assistance to tribes to recover from droughts, floods, wildfires, and snowstorms. Nine area tribes participated in the event, and some national tribal leaders were there, including the president of the National Congress of American Indians. Samuel Jesse Smith was a Navajo code talker who served in the military during World War II. The 88-year-old died last week after an illness. Reporter Ashley Gross traveled with Smith to some Pacific battlefield sites several years ago for the making of a documentary and has this remembrance of him.
When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Smith was just 16, but he fudged his age to get into the Marines. In 2006, Smith sat at an airport gate and remembered how his grandfather, a medicine man, told him he was too young to go to war.
Grandson, you're still a punk. You're not even a man yet. And he said, I bet you haven't had sex yet. And I thought right there, what does sex have to do with me going in the combat? I'm going to do a job, defend my country, my land.
Smith went to boot camp in the summer of 1943, and his grandfather gave him a black arrowhead and an eagle plume for protection. Smith wanted to be a pilot, but the Marine brass tapped him to send battlefield messages in his native language. He fought in four Pacific battles, including Iwo Jima. He narrowly escaped getting mowed down by Japanese machine guns.
Was that scary when they'd come running at you?
I don't know what is scary. When somebody runs at you to kill you, you kill first.
Still, he wasn't able to forget what he had seen. Smith had nightmares that were so vivid he once broke his toe kicking the bedroom wall. In later years, Smith received medals for his service as a code talker, but he said there was another kind of recognition he cared about even more.
One thing that mattered to me was my grandpa. You promote me to man. That was important to me.
Smith said he wasn't sad he never got to be a pilot. Historians agree the code talkers were invaluable.
That's how the war was won. Period.
A service for Smith was held on April 21st in New Mexico. For National Native News, I'm Ashley Gross.
Today, we remember George Horse Capture Sr., who passed away in April 2013. He was one of the first Native American museum curators in the U.S. Horse Capture Sr. was in charge of the Plains Indian Museum at the Buffalo Bill Historical Center in Wyoming. He also worked at the National Museum of the American Indian and was involved in books, film, and television. The Gros Ventre man was 75 years old at the time of his death. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, showers in the evening with a high of 59. Sunday should be similar with a high of 54. On April 25, 1917, Ella Fitzgerald was born. Also on this date in 1898, the U.S. declared war on Spain and launched the Spanish-American War. And exactly 40 years ago, the Carnation Revolution occurred in Portugal, with a coup overthrowing the regime of Estado Novo without firing a shot. Thousands took to the streets, placing carnations in the muzzles of the army's rifles. Our quote of the day comes from Ella Fitzgerald. "It isn't where you came from, it's where you're going that counts."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Mothers everywhere warn children not to put any food in their mouths unless they know where it came from. The same should apply to putting information in our heads. For instance, the Employment Policy Institute has recently run full-page newspaper ads alerting the public and policymakers that an impressive group of some 650 economists who are supporting an increase in America's minimum wage includes many who are radical researchers. The Institute's message is that no one should listen to, much less respect, this group of economists. But wait, many in the group are radical? How many? The ads only list 8 and offers only innuendo as, quote, proof of their radicalism. And by the way, what and who is the Employment Policy Institute? Sounds legit, but is it? Not at all. It's a nonprofit front group run by longtime corporate operative Richard Berman. It gets millions of dollars in tax-exempt donations from fast food chains and other corporate interests trying to kill the wage increase, then funnels that money into Berman's for-profit PR firm, which also represents the restaurant industry. To make its case, the Institute has cited several, quote, academic reports that assail the wage increase on multiple fronts. But just as Berman refuses to disclose the names of the corporate giants funding him, he also never mentions that more than half of the economists whose papers he cites are paid by him. One, Joseph Sabia, has been given $250,000 in 8 grants from Berman's Institute. In addition, an independent analysis of one of Sabia's reports found that the data was skewed to make it seem that a New York wage hike had a negative impact on employment, which simply was not true. This is Jim Hightower saying, this phony institute is a scam and a scandal. So, Mama says, don't put any of its stuff in your head.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The radioactive water pouring into the Pacific Ocean from the Fukushima nuclear power plant has continued to worsen. The manager of Fukushima Reactor Number 1 has admitted this week that the radioactive water outflow, estimated at 400 tons per day, is out of control, and there's no technology in existence to counter the radiation releases. TEPCO, its owner and operator, is trying to permanently freeze the ground in and around the plant to keep water from flowing into the Pacific Ocean. The process has never been tried before, but the plans call for the ground to be permanently frozen for at least the next 1,000 years. The International Atomic Energy Agency has recently said that dumping the water into the ocean is most likely the only solution to the water storage problem. Currently, there are over 1,000 single-walled tanks filled with highly radioactive water pumped from the basement containment areas where the active fuel cores are thought to be located. Many of the tanks were poorly constructed and are leaking. TEPCO is continuously pumping water into the reactor building in an attempt to keep the fuel cores, which are still hot, from exploding and releasing massive amounts of radioactivity into the atmosphere. Its new plan calls for pumping all groundwater from the Fukushima power plant before it becomes contaminated, but it admits that this could cause the ground to subside. The ex-mayor of Futaba City in Fukushima Prefecture recently said that many adverse health effects and sudden deaths have hit the Fukushima area, where up to 2 million people still live. The current evacuation zone is only a 12-mile radius, and the city of Tokyo, site of the 2020 Summer Olympics, is less than 140 miles from the Fukushima power plant. Black mold and dust in the Tokyo area and at numerous sites to be used during the 2020 Summer Olympics have been found to be material from the fuel core that exploded during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami that fatally injured the nuclear power plant.
Standard & Poor's announcement of their intention to downgrade Russia's credit rating may not have the expected impact. A comparable designation befell Venezuela earlier this year, but the shift actually seemed to spur the economy there. The Center for Economic and Policy Research spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about how and why S&P's declarations might not be as influential as the McGraw-Hill subsidiary is accustomed to.
I'm talking with Mark Weisbrot. He is the co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Standard & Poor's announced a drop in Russia's credit rating, citing tension in the region. Can you explain what impact this shift might have on that nation's economy?
I don't know that it'll have any, because I don't know how much credibility they really have or how seriously the bond markets are going to take their rating. You know, they're quite politicized. There's S&P and Moody's and Fitch. They control over 90% of the ratings market and also their revenue, a multi-billion-dollar industry. But they're also very politicized. For example, they lowered U.S. debt. S&P did in 2012. They lowered the credit rating for the United States. And that was, you know, at a time when there was a big battle over the deficit and the budget. There's really no threat whatsoever the United States would ever default on its debt. Then there was also, during the run-up in the housing bubble between 2000 and 2007, these rating agencies, including S&P, they gave AAA readings to tens of thousands of bonds and other instruments that turned out to be worthless. In fact, there was a hearing, one of the congressional hearings after the financial crisis. The Congress people read aloud an email between two S&P employees where they said that they would give a rating to a deal even if it were structured by cows. And so they don't really have a lot of credibility. Now, in terms of Russia itself, you know, they've got hundreds of billions of dollars of reserves. And I don't really see these sanctions having that much of an impact on the Russian economy.
Who provides rating agencies with some level of oversight? What criteria is used to establish credibility? I mean, it seems to me that if back in 2008 and 9, the credit rating agencies on the whole were discovered as culpable with regard to a little incident I have dubbed fraud closure gate, is there not somebody who can put them in a penalty box and keep them from issuing ratings?
Well, there actually have been proposals. Obviously, legislation hasn't been passed or we would know about it. But there were proposals in Congress in the aftermath of the horrific failure of these agencies. giving AAA ratings to what turned out to be worthless junk, like billions of dollars of it. There were efforts to create a federally regulated ratings agency, and they didn't get off the ground. But that would be the solution, is to have something that everybody could trust doing the ratings, rather than these private companies who have their own agenda.
What kind of credentials are required to give these entities the authority to rate anything?
Well, it isn't a question of credentials. They just kind of monopolize the business, or it's an oligopoly. There's three of them.
I've been talking with Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. For more information, you can visit their website at cepr.net. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
In the latest news from Afghanistan, heavy rains pounded three provinces in the northern region of the country. This led to flooding, claiming the lives of 102 people. If they survive the storm, it will still affect the livelihood of the thousands of people who reside in these mostly rural areas. In Faryab, over 100,000 domestic animals and livestock died in the storm. The nearby province of Jazjan suffered a similar fate, where more than 30 villages remain underwater. Locals recounted stories of people climbing trees to escape from rising water levels.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Carl Vischer, Don Zer. The producer is Ryan Katz, and our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of the local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter